In the discourses of the Buddha, there's the record of a conversation the Buddha had with the people in the town of Kalama. They're called the Kalamas. And this conversation he had with them is considered very important and was preserved. And now it's called the Discourse, the Kalama Discourse, the Sutta, Kalama Sutta. And Yvonne Rand, who's a Zen teacher from the San Francisco Zen Center, she believes, she said once, that this particular discourse of the Buddha should be tattooed on the inside of every Buddhist practitioner's eyelids. It's kind of maybe a little bit unfortunate image exactly, but the idea is that it's such an important discourse that it, you should always have it ready at hand. So you close your eyes, you see it, there it is. And partly she had such a strong opinion about this discourse because she was kind of at the epicenter for a lot of different ways in which people related to Buddhism in a dysfunctional way, in an unhealthy way, where people gave up their own authority, their own good sense, their own ability to find their own way out of faith, out of in teachers, or faith in kind of blind faith in teachings. And she saw the tremendous damage that created for a lot of people in the 1980s in particular in Buddhist America. And she felt, oh, if you keep this discourse in mind, you're going to save yourself a lot of grief. So the discourse takes place when the Buddha comes to the town of Kalama. Yes?
I can't hear.
Oh, you can't hear. Yeah, I should always check. Always, I forget to check. Let's see. Sounds a little dull. We don't want that. The Dharma is cutting edge. Let's see. I tried higher. Hello? Is that better? But I don't want to hold. I think we're exactly where you're sitting. I get the impression the right kind of place right there is often kind of a dead spot or odd spot. But Henry says it's odd here for him too. So is that better higher up like this? Is that better?
Now it has an echo.
Would you mind moving? Maybe if it's is it troubling the people around you also, Cheryl?
It's not good.
It's good. It's muffled. It's muddy. Maybe I got a good night's sleep last night. So let's see. Is that any better? For you, it's better. We can all join you there. Can we continue? Or we'd like to get it right. You can hear. That sounds better now. Sounds better now. It's a very temperamental system. And so, I apologize. So, let's try again now. So, the discourse of the Kalamas. The Buddha comes into this town. And this town is like the San Francisco Bay Area. In that, it's a lot smaller, but in that there's a lot of spiritual teachers that come through or live here. Just lots and lots and lots. And as maybe, I don't know if it happens that much around here. I don't go checking different teachers. But back then, teachers would show up and say, I have the right way. And this is the true way, the right way. And the other people, they don't have it right. I have the right way. And these Kalamas found it a little bit confusing to have different teachers. If only one person said, I have the right way, then it's pretty clear. But to have a lot of different people say, this is the right way, then, you know, what do you do? How are you going to choose between them? So the Buddha was just one more of these people coming through town. And so they said, well, let's ask him, how do you make sense of this? How do you decide who is right? So rather than giving the Buddha a chance to kind of say what his way is, he said, you know, kind of like a testing, partly testing him and partly asking a very important question. How in the wide diversity of spiritual teachings, how do you find the right way or the true way or the helpful way? How do you find your way in it? Who do you know? And the Buddha then replies that by telling them first that it's fitting, it's appropriate for them to be confused, to ask these questions, not to know. And then he says something that says something which has been repeated over and over again by many Buddhists, many Buddhist teachers. Particularly, there's like a little paragraph in the way it's recorded. And sometimes that particular paragraph is taken by itself. And sometimes it's reduced, shrunk, to just like one sentence. And sometimes it's that one sentence is a little bit of a... maybe taken too far to, beyond what it actually means. But sometimes it's reduced to something like trust yourself. Trust your own experience. Trust what you know. And that's probably a little bit too simplistic for what the Buddha had in mind. But you kind of, it's kind of going in that direction with what he says. It also, what he says in this undermines or pulls the rug from underneath most forms of spiritual authority that human beings rely on. And if you kind of you can use your imagination as I read it to you to imagine, you know, how many people in the world who engage in spiritual life are taking as their authority for what is true one of these sources. And you'll also appreciate the fact that I'm reading from one of those kinds of sources is kind of a paradox. Or so the Buddha then replies to the Kalamas, "It is fitting for you to be perplexed. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Listen, don't go by oral tradition." The expression is more literally, don't go by what you've heard. Don't go by what you've heard. "By lineage of teaching, by the authority of a teaching lineage, by hearsay, by rumors, by scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoning your way, a reflection on reasons, by acceptance of a view after thinking about it, or because of the seeming competence of a speaker." Thank you. "Or because you think this person is our teacher." So, what's left? So don't go just because you heard it, that's the way it is. Don't go for it, but, you know, it's this whole scripture thing, you know. You know, just because it's in a scripture, don't depend on that because of that. And rumors certainly shouldn't go on. But your reasoning, just because you can reason out and it seems logical, don't go for that. That's, you know, not a reliable source of spiritual authority or belief. Inferential reasoning, some people have interpreted that to mean because it feels right. Don't go with something just because it feels right or you think it out that it's right. Sometimes when we think something out, or sometimes when we read something, or sometimes when we hear something, it's true, it's right, and sometimes it's not. Just because it comes from those sources is not enough for you to know that something is true or accurate or right. So then the Buddha offers the alternative, the kind of what you can rely on. "But when you know for yourselves," it doesn't stop there. It doesn't say "when you know for yourself." It says, "When you know for yourselves, these things are unskillful. These things are blamable. These things are censored by the wise. These things, if undertaken or practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And when you know for yourself, these things are skillful, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them." So he gives you the criteria. He gives you criteria by which to judge teachings or practices of how to live your life. And the end of it, he says, when you can know for yourself that this leads to your welfare and to welfare and to happiness, or the opposite, when it causes harm and unhappiness. So there's a kind of a empirical test that hopefully every individual person is able to discern for him or herself, and that is this harmful or is it beneficial? Can we see the difference between the choices we make? And to help with that, then the Buddha elaborates a little bit more by this idea of skillful. Is it skillful or unskillful? And skillful here means, is it helpful of leading towards that which is our welfare and happiness? Or is it unskillful? Is it those things which maybe in and of itself maybe is not a problem, but it leads towards unhappiness, leads towards lack of welfare, to our harm? And then it isn't just completely something if you rely on by yourself. There is a suggestion here that you listen to wise people. And it isn't that you necessarily believe them, but you give them maybe some benefit of the doubt. These things are praised by the wise, or these things are censored by the wise. You know, if you want to learn any skill at all, you could, you know, if you want to learn how to play, I don't know, the piano, you could. I mean, some people, I guess, are musical geniuses, and they sit down and they just figure it all out. But it's a kind of inefficient way to do it. And you go to someone who knows how to play the piano, and they can kind of give you pointers and make it much more efficient to find out how to do it, because they kind of tell you a little bit the terrain, the area, what it's about. So same thing with spiritual life. You can kind of get a little bit closer to, make it a little more efficient for you if you listen to people who are wise. That doesn't mean you believe them, but they kind of listen to them and say, oh, if they say, oh, it might be good for you to meditate. You know, then you can be quiet enough in your mind, still enough in your mind, so you can really be very discerning about what causes harm and what causes benefit, what brings happiness and what brings unhappiness. It takes a very quiet mind, a very still mind, to see deeply into what is it that really brings lasting happiness and well-being. What are the forces within us? Be able to make very deep, subtle choices in our self-identity, on where we hold on to sense of self. So, oh, if I hold on to this kind of sense of self, this idea of who I think I need to be, that actually is not helpful for me. It actually creates unhappiness for me. It's very hard to see how we are attached and hold on to a sense of self. So the wise say, because it's hard, it's really good if you can get quiet and still and concentrated. Take a concentration class. And get quiet and still so you can kind of see, well, what's going on. So our own experience becomes the primary criteria for finding our way. But we kind of use some benefit of what's here called the wise. In a different discourse with the Buddha, he talks about two primary factors that a person needs in order to go on the Buddhist path to liberation. One is a person needs to have wise reflection, to be able to use one's own mind and heart to reflect and consider and to see and to make choices about what direction to take our life in. And a person needs to have good spiritual friends, to have models, to have community, to have people from whom we can get feedback, we can mirrors for ourselves, people can we can converse with and talk about and explore what's going on. That those two combinations are two really essential ingredients in order to be able to find our way. It's not completely doing it alone, but it's not turning our authority over to anybody else, but kind of doing it more cooperatively, getting help and discussion, conversation and examples. So I find this emphasis of the spiritual life very refreshing, because in my mind, as I encounter it and as I live and practice this, it seems very simple. It's a very simple practice, and because it's so simple, it's deceivingly simple, and it's very easy to overlook how profound it might be. And this is simple to watch very carefully, to watch yourself and make those choices that lead towards peace or to happiness. But you have to know what happiness is really reliable. You know, some people might think the good choice for becoming happy is to buy a lot of lottery tickets. Now, that's not a wise way of finding happiness. That's an unskillful way. So again, looking for what is skillful to allow us to have some lasting, ongoing level of peace and well-being. Rather than seeking outside of ourselves and running around chasing things, chasing teachings, teaching practices, the image this sutta presents me is the image of just kind of sitting down under a tree, as the Buddha did, in a very simple place, and then beginning to look at one's own heart, one's own mind, and to see what choices can I make to make my heart simpler, more open, more peaceful, more happy. What is that? So, the Buddha then goes on in this discourse to give kind of some examples. He says, "What do you think? When greed, hatred, or delusion arise in a person, is it for his or her welfare or harm?" And the Kalamas answer, "It's for that person's harm. That the presence of greed, hate, and delusion brings harm." And then the Buddha asks, "When non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion arise in a person, is it for his or her welfare or harm?" And this time the Kalamas say, "It's for his or her welfare." Non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion are understood to imply the opposites of greed, hate, and delusion. So non-greed is generosity, non-hatred is love, loving-kindness, and non-delusion is wisdom. So here, the Buddha said, look at your own mind and your own heart and notice the qualities, the quality of it. Is what's happening now being influenced by greed, hate, and delusion, or the opposite qualities? And when greed or hate and delusion are present, can you see if this is helpful for you or not? And if you have the ability to notice that, at least the teachings of the Buddha are that greed, hate, and delusion are always going to be for your harm. So to begin taking responsibility for the winds of our mind, the winds of our heart, are we moving towards greed, wanting things and grabbing and ambition? Are we moving towards hatred and living with the hatred, picking it up and running with it, or with delusion? Can we simplify the mind? Can we quiet the mind so it doesn't not caught up by those forces? And rather than just living a passive life, can we pick up the qualities of mind that have to do with generosity, with love, and with wisdom? And can we live by those? Those things lead towards our welfare. Then the discourse goes on a little bit further and says, if a person can purify him or herself of greed, hate, and delusion, just temporarily, just find some ability to be quiet or be peaceful, be settled enough so that greed, hate, and delusion don't have the upper hand in a heart and a mind. Then, if the person cultivates loving kindness, or cultivates compassion, or cultivates what's called sympathetic joy, or cultivates a particular form of love Buddhists use the word equanimity to describe this kind of love. If you cultivate one of these four kinds of love, one of four things will result. One of four benefits will happen to the person. And that is, and this is kind of, you know, Pascal's wager? Pascal's wager, I understand. Is that right, Pascal? Or is it? No? Anyway, this is, if God exists, you're better off kind of believing, you're better off living as if God exists than not. Because if God exists, and you live as if God exists, then live accordingly and live a good life, then you'll be rewarded and go to heaven. And that's pretty good. If God doesn't exist, but you live as if God exists, you'll live a really good life here. In this life, this lifetime will be good. You won't get in trouble. You won't go to jail and stuff. And so you're better off living as if God exists. That's Pascal's wager. So this is a kind of, the Buddha had the same kind of idea, not with God. And that is, so if you live a life, if you practice this loving kindness, live a life that comes out of the love of your heart, then one of four things will occur. If there is rebirth, you'll get a really good rebirth. If there is no rebirth, then you'll live a life that's pure and beautiful here and now. If your actions now have consequences in the future, in this lifetime, if the seeds you plant now are going to sprout in a year or 2 years or 10 years, then if you plant the seeds of love, they're going to sprout for your benefit, bring fruit in the future. If your actions now do not bring fruit in the future, they just kind of exist for themselves, then you've done something really beautiful now that's very satisfying for your well-being here and now. So you're better off doing these things, because it either leads to your benefit now or it will lead to your benefit in the future, whatever, you know, is really the case. And so then the story goes on. The Kalamas were delighted by what the Buddha had to say. And they asked if they would become, according to this record, followers of the Buddha. They were satisfied with what he had to say and said, okay, we'll choose you. You're the one. So to be able to discern, to be able to pay attention, to be mindful enough to see what's going on with the quality of our own heart, to know whether the quality of our heart, the actions of our heart, the activity of our heart is leading to our harm or to our benefit. In particular, but looking and seeing, is there greed operating here? Is there hate operating here? Is there delusion? Is there love? Is there generosity? Or is there wisdom? It takes some doing. It takes patience. It takes practice. It takes time to be able to watch oneself clearly enough to see all these things. If you're greedy for winning the California lottery, maybe you can see that pretty quickly. But there can be very subtle movements of attachment, of clinging. But the subtle ones aren't a trifling thing. The subtle ones are often the most deeply rooted ones, the ones that have the most consequence. So to sit still enough and begin watching and seeing, and take responsibility for the quality of one's own heart. And so, for example, if you sit and meditate or any other activity which brings you a good quality of being, you go for a walk in nature, or you listen to music or play music or something that kind of makes you feel good in a nice way, is that something we can use as a teacher, as our teacher? What can you learn from that once you kind of touch into that? Can you pay attention to when the mind leaves that? When you pick up or get caught up in greed, hate, and delusion, or anxiety, or worry, or fear? And watch that and say, oh, wait a minute, let's pay attention to this. Let's watch this. And can I let go of that? Oh, no, I can't let go. It's not so easy. Okay, so what's skillful here? Given that I can't let go of my anxiety, what's skillful? What's a skillful thing to do? And so let's follow what is skillful. So what the Buddha is offering here, I believe, is offering a way in which each individual person can find their own path. and not a path in some. And the Buddha, I think the Buddha is suggesting it isn't like some you can find any path at all. But he's suggesting the path that leads towards peace, to happiness, and to lasting well-being. Each person needs to find their own way. And so I think no one can give a generic path that's going to fit everybody. But there's a very simple principle that he's offering, and that is follow that path that is skillful and skillfully moves you towards what is beneficial, what is peaceful, what is kind of improves that wonderful quality of happiness that is available for everybody, in everybody's heart. When I was thinking about this topic, I remembered a passage from Thomas Merton's diaries when he went to Sri Lanka. And he was very interested in Buddhism, and he did a kind of a tour of Buddhist Asia shortly before he died. And he wrote this in his diary, visiting a temple in Sri Lanka. The path dips down to the temple, a wide, quiet hollow surrounded with trees, a low outcrop of rock with a cave cut into it, and besides the cave, a big seated Buddha on the left and a reclining Buddha on the right. I'm able to approach the Buddhas barefoot and undisturb my feet in wet grass, wet sand. So this introduction to what's about to happen is very nice because this is described as someone who's mindful, who's really present, who feels the sand, feels the grass, the wetness, kind of recognizes where he is. So very simple presence and mindfulness. Then the silence of the extraordinary faces of these big statues that he saw there. The great smiles, huge and yet subtle, filled with every possibility, questioning nothing, knowing everything, rejecting nothing, the peace not of emotional resignation, but of emptiness that has seen through every question without trying to discredit anyone or anything, without refutation, without establishing some other argument. For the doctrinaire, the mind that needs well-established positions, such peace, such silence can be frightening. I was knocked over with a rush of relief and thankfulness at the obvious clarity of the figures, the clarity and fluidity of shape and line, the design of the monumental bodies composed into the rock, shape and landscape, figure, rock, and tree. So to experience a kind of peace that can exist without refutation, without refuting anything, without being for and against spiritual teachings of other people. So the Buddha didn't refute the other teachers who came through. He didn't say, oh, all those people are wrong. But rather he offered people a way of finding peace on their own, finding what is useful for them. If some other teachers have useful teachings that lead towards peace and happiness and well-being, then follow those teachings. If they don't, then don't follow them. What is it that brings you, what brings you welfare and well-being? When I was in Thailand, with Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, the assistant abbot was Ajahn Po. And I spent a fair amount of time with him. I liked him a lot. And one day he said to me, if you come to a monastery and you don't find it helpful to be there, it's a little bit dangerous teaching, but he said, if you don't find it helpful, he said, then you should leave so quickly you don't have time to say goodbye to the abbot. And hopefully, when you realize it's not helpful, it's for really good reasons. Some people will, as soon as a practice becomes challenging, a situation becomes challenging, they're out of there. And sometimes what's skillful and beneficial for our long-term happiness is staying present for what is challenging and being involved and looking more deeply. If we're always running away from difficulty, we'll never become peaceful. But it was a very nice little teaching of, Ajahn Po was, you know, that we should actually be able to judge and for ourselves what is beneficial and useful, and be able to make choices based on that. So teachings are not so important. What's important is each of us finding our own path. And maybe it doesn't follow the logic from what I've said so far, but my sense of this kind of teaching is that it points to something, to a simplicity of being, to a simplicity of way of being in the world, and taking responsibility in that simplicity for who we are and how we are, what we do. Anyway, that's what's on my mind for today. And do you have any comments that you'd like to make, or questions, or clarifications?
So clear about delusion.
Yeah, delusion is hard to see. Delusion can be quite hard to see because it's kind of camouflages itself. You know, you think we. Sometimes, if it takes the form of confusion, then we can feel we're confused. But delusion is like seeing something and believing it's one thing when it's really something else. If the mind is quite mindful, if we're quite mindful, or quiet enough to be quite mindful. It's possible. Delusion is always an activity of the mind. The mind does something. The mind thinks something. The mind creates an idea or an image. And if you're quiet enough or mindful enough, you can watch that image, that idea, arise. And you can see that that idea is different from what's actually being seen, from the actual experience there. Often our minds and the way we live our life is so fast that we don't see the difference between our interpretation of the event, the situation, and the situation itself. But if you can watch how that the creative activity of the mind works, and you can see that the creative activity is different from the thing out there, then you have a better chance of seeing that this is not representing what's out there. This is a delusion. This is a projection. This is an imagination. And the imagination might have some truth to it, but because you see it arising in your own mind, hopefully a person then can question it and say, well, I don't know if this is really the case. Maybe I should go check this out. Maybe I should mention this to my friend. You know, I have this idea about you. I saw this idea surface in my mind. I don't know if it's true, but what do you think of that? And the person says, oh yeah, that's exactly how I feel or how it is. Or, oh no. Not at all. When I said that, I didn't mean that at all. That's your, you read into it too much. So be able to watch the creative activity of the mind is a very important part of being able to discern delusion. Does that make some sense? Would you like to ask more? What's behind your question? No? When we watch our own hearts, the quality of our hearts, the quality of our mind, and especially I think if you can realize the happiness that's available in the simplicity of our hearts, simplicity of just being, then one of the ways of finding our path in this way that the Buddha talks about, I believe, is to be very attentive not to sacrifice that well-being. And it's very interesting to study how quickly we're willing to sacrifice our well-being, and to study that, not just kind of dismiss it or be upset by it, but to actually begin studying and investigating. What's going on here? Why I had this great morning, you know, I had this great sit, or I had this great walk, or I had this, you know, woke up quite refreshed and relaxed from my night's sleep, or whatever, you know. And you recognize that you had this good feeling. And then you notice, I'm no longer feeling so good. I feel anxious, or I feel angry, or I feel upset, or I feel confused. What happened there? What was the transition from feeling at peace or feeling good to feeling upset? What was that happen there? That's a really important area of studying. This whole thing plays itself out there in that interface. For what are we willing to sacrifice our well-being? And probably a lot of people find themselves willing, making continual sacrifices, saying, oh, the situation I find myself is so important, so dire, that I can't take the time to go back to my sense of well-being or to investigate what's going on. I have to kind of rush in and take care of things. It's a crisis. Or whatever. So, but what are the arguments in your mind, implicit or explicit, for which you're willing to sacrifice your well-being? And then if you look at those arguments, look at the beliefs for why you're willing to sacrifice your well-being, then the question is, upon what authority do you have that this is a useful thing to do? Is there some, what's the authority for that belief? And chances are, I believe, that there's no reliable authority to support the idea that any human being is supposed to sacrifice a good heart. If anyone can come up with a good authority for me, I would like to hear about it. Oh.
Well, it's usually a reaction to fear.
Usually a reaction to fear.
Just why I sacrifice.
A reaction. So can you? She said usually it's a reaction to fear that she sacrifices her well-being. And without the long story, very briefly, could you just play that out a little bit, how that works for you? You use the mic if you don't mind. Jeannie, if you don't mind, could you?
Elaborating.
Just an outline.
Outline. That was the first thing that came to mind, because I work with drug addicts and alcoholics and people in recovery, and what I was thinking is, you know, what is it that makes us drawn to our addiction, to which is the opposite of our well-being?
Yeah.
And so the kind of knee-jerk reaction is what takes us and makes us decide against that. You know, this is good for us, this is skillful, this is our well-being. And what I've seen is it's when a somatic fear, cellular fear, that maybe goes back to the experience of trauma or disease, mm-hmm. or whatever, discomfort, makes us choose the giving up of our well-being.
Yeah. And what have you learned is skillful to do when that fear arises for you?
Watch the breath. Pay attention to the body sensation.
Uh-huh.
Try to soften the heart. And something I learned from you in many years is looking at what's behind it and what's behind that.
Uh-huh.
And you know, just tracking that to where you get to the ability to make a choice for the well-being.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yes.
Just following up on what you're saying there, I guess one question I would have is when the means justify the end. So the sutra you were mentioning, you know, talks about is it skillful in the now or is it skillful in the future? There are some things that are apparently unskillful now, but you do it because in the future it'll be skillful. So, for example, when I yell at my kids, right, get angry at them, that leads to a disruption in my own sense of well-being, but I know that it's an appropriate thing to do.
But it's appropriate thing to do.
It's appropriate thing to do. At least that's my feeling, because, you know, they've done something that could be potentially dangerous for them or something that will, you know, if it's not corrected, will lead to something in the future. So my reaction now... Maybe there's a way to do it that's not in an angry manner, but still it seems as a parent, it seems appropriate to get angry at them. And so while you're angry, you're going to be physically not in the state that you'd like to be. But it seems justified.
Well, it's justified.
Yeah.
And
I'll give even a broader example. Let's say the need to, go to war. You know, I mean, does the end justify to some extent the means? And so there's a small example and then a large example where, you know, I mean, it seems like it comes up oftentimes where your actions at the moment are not generous, loving. Or wise, apparently, or you ultimately think it's wise, but those first two. But then you know at the end, hopefully, you'll achieve that you're doing it because you want to achieve something at the end that will be generous or
So I've noticed that when, I have these little boys at home, right? And so a few things I say using that example, and that can be kind of expanded out probably to other situations like nations. But a few things. One is that I have occasionally spoken angrily, very kind of brief, kind of loud anger to my older son because of something. And it seemed like that worked great, you know. He shaped up and everyone was happier. It was great. Sometimes. But what's happening is that he's now using that voice for his younger brother. And it's not appropriate. And it's, uh-oh. Where did he learn that from? And that's one thing. And the other thing is that when I've come back from retreats, in particular, when I do a lot of sitting and I have a lot of clarity and a lot of, much more mindfulness than I normally have in daily life, my wife has noticed that I am much wiser in how I relate to the children. So my buttons don't get pushed as quickly. And so rather than responding in an angry way, I'll go over to my son and say, I'll sit down next to him and say, look, we have to talk. You have to look at me, look at my face when I talk to you. And we have to, there's all kinds of things I do, but I have access to a wider range of skillful things besides anger when I'm present and clear in a good way. And so the suggestion I'd have is, to anybody who ever wants to use anger and feels it justified, that pause for some time and really think out, are there any other options that might be just as effective? And it's my belief that there's always other options that are probably not only just as effective, but probably in the long term much more effective. And if you can find those other more effective things, then you also, the side benefit is that you get to safeguard your heart from getting angry. But it's really hard with kids, boy. So if you'll forgive me, I want to say one more thing around this whole area, is that people seem very quick to want to justify anger, and sometimes justify violence. And I'm not going to say that it's never appropriate. I don't want to be in that position exactly to say never. But I remember some years ago, a woman came to me when we were in Palo Alto and asked my opinion about whether she should get a handgun, because she would park in downtown Palo Alto at night and have to go to her car in the dark parking lots. It felt very unsafe, and thought if she had a handgun, she could become safer. And I actually didn't want to be in a position of making advice exactly, you know, tell her what you should or shouldn't do about a handgun. It's not, but what I said something like, I think it's kind of sad if people go to the easy or the obvious option of getting a gun before having investigated the other options that are possible. There might be other options. There's all kinds of training, for example, in self-defense moves. Or, you know, maybe it's a can of mace, or maybe it's just parking someplace else, or, you know, there's other options. And so to take some time, and some of these other options take education, take learning, you learn skills. You know, study Aikido, for example. And Aikido is not going to guarantee that it protects you in all situations, but you probably increase the options of getting out of a situation in a healthy way than a gun would do. And so the idea of sometimes alternatives to anger, alternatives to violence, take effort on our part. It takes study, it takes training, it takes effort. And some people are unwilling to take the time to investigate and learn about other options. They don't have time, they're lazy, or they're busy, and they're just going to do the quick and easy thing. And the quick and easy thing sometimes is not for the long-term benefit. Okay, so I hope this was useful for you, for your benefit. And if not, then leave what was said here. Don't take it with you. Thank you.